Welcome! It is such a pleasure to have you all here. I'm the Reverend Christian Schmidt. I'm one of the ministers of this congregation, which is the Unitarian Universalist Church of Berkeley. We're so pleased to have you here. This is a wonderful event we host each year, the Lawrence Lecture, in which we invite influential and interesting speakers on topics of our day to come tell us what they're thinking about and probably what we should be thinking about too. We've had a huge array of speakers over the years. We have a great one tonight. I'm so pleased you're here. If there is anything you need at any time, I'm around. The bathroom's around the atrium, if you didn't notice on the way in. It's one of my duties to let you know that sort of thing. We're going to have a lecture and then some questions. Afterwards, Tim will be here to sign books. And again, I'm just so happy to have you. I do want to recognize one group of people, the Lawrence Lecture Committee, which makes this happen each year. So, I think they were busy. Some of them were in the room, and some of them were still busy out helping some last-minute takers. So welcome again. I hope you have a wonderful time. I'm really looking forward to this. I want to invite Orlani Mosley to introduce our speaker.
Good evening. On October 1st, 1968, that was the second month of my freshman year at Temple University in Philadelphia. And it would be a couple of more days before Tim Wise was born that October. And in 1968, the world was blowing up. Martin was killed in April, Bobby was killed in June, and I hit the campus in September with my white guitar-playing hippie boyfriend, Benny.
So the revolution had come to Temple University in the form of the black students had banded together and taken over tables in the corner, and no one dared to sit with them except me and Benny. And of course, we were ignored and sneered at, and how dare I, as a black woman, have a white boyfriend? But we came every day for lunch, and we sat at the end of the table. So one day, Ben and I were walking on campus, and a group of the guys from the dining hall came up to us. And one of them said, "Sister, what are you gonna do when the revolution comes and you're with this white man?" So Ben squeezed my hand a little, and then he stepped up, and he said, "Who do you think they're going to let buy the guns when the revolution comes?" "That's going to be me, right?" And we were astonished. I mean, we just stared at him because we were middle-class kids and hadn't thought through what the revolution really would be like. And also, we were astonished that here was a white man saying aloud, "I will stand with you." So everybody was speechless for a minute, and then, you know, the guys were cool, and Ben and I got the head nod, and then they let us pass. So from then on, it was a matter of us having a permanent seat at the table with the black students and all these kids. We thought we were ready for the revolution. So in the years that followed, I went my way and Ben went his, and the revolution was televised. I started my own tech business, and I learned many cruel lessons about being black in America. I forgot that feeling that white people could ever be a support and an advocate for black people until I read Tim Wise's book, White Like Me, Reflections on Race, from a Privileged Son. I read that book twice, and I said, "Who is this guy?" So, let me get myself here together. I found out, you know, over time, looking up Tim's record, that even as a child, he was an advocate for fighting oppression and racism and anti-Semitism. In high school, he was an activist. And in college, at my age when I was in college, he was already leading anti-apartheid movements. So after graduating college, he became associate director of an organization that stopped that neo-Klansman, David Duke, from becoming a Louisiana senator in 1991. And that organization that he was an associate director for stopped Duke from becoming governor also. And guess what? Tim wasn't even yet 25 years old. Now he is hailed as one of the most prominent anti-racist essayists, educators, and activists in the United States. He's written 7 books, each one diving deeper into racism, institutionalized racism, classism, and he dives deeper into our psyches. This man takes no prisoners. I've had my own naive self handed back to me on a platter after reading some of Tim's books, particularly the book Between Barack and a Hard Place. So his unflinching clarity has educated me and others. If you get the ability to buy that video of the conversation between Tim and Angela Davis, it's called The Vocabulary of Change. It is so powerful to listen to them talk with each other. Two warriors with long histories of speaking truth to power, and they continue to speak out in the world even though their lives have been threatened. You know, we Unitarians also have a long history and commitment to speaking truth to power. We started the ACLU, the Red Cross, and even helped start the NAACP. But the seeming intractableness of racism in America has brought many of us close to the place of despair. At our social justice group here called the Literature, Film, and Drama Contingent, we read the hard books, the ones that make us cry, the ones that make us set our jaw, and promise not to just talk about, but confront racism, anti-Semitism, and unconscious bias in our everyday lives. So last year we read Tim's book, White Like Me, and though many of us had read it previously, when we read the latest edition, it really rocked us. And afterwards, everyone wanted to see if he could come and give us a hard talk and some hard encouragement. Brilliant political analyst and professor Michael Eric Dyson calls Tim Wise one of the greatest public moralists in America today. So it's been my pleasure to introduce, and I'm so grateful that we have with us this evening, Tim Wise.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. It is good to see you here. And I mean that very literally, because when we pulled up, my dear friend Felicia, with whom I have worked at Speak Out for about a quarter century, and I pulled in, and we were in that front lot, you know, the one near the tiny homes, and there were no cars, right? And I was sort of like, all right, I mean, you know, I know I've been at this a minute and people have heard me before, but really, like, no one's going to come. Like, this is horribly humiliating. I've been on the road for 2 weeks. I had a bunch of people at Sac State last night. I thought I was doing all right. And then, like, there's nobody. And I know it's a steep hill. And we're in the clouds at about 27,000 feet, from what I can gather. And my ears are still popping. And I thought, well, all right, you know, maybe it's time to call it a day. And then we sort of saw the sign that was obscured by a branch. And it said main entrance. And it had a little arrow going around the back. And we thought, oh, all right, well, maybe there's another way to get in. And sure enough, there was. And we came around the corner. And here were all of you people. So thank you for that. I appreciate that. Because it was really not going to be a good way to end this 2 weeks on the road if I had nobody to speak to. So here's the thing. You just heard this really wonderful introduction. I appreciate you for it, except for one part, and that is when you're reminded how long that you've been at this, both the living thing, but also the this work part of it. You do get a little wistful and a little bit reflective, maybe in a maudlin kind of way, and you start to reflect on what it means, and I'm sure many of you do the same, what it means to have been working on racial justice for 25 years, 30 years, 50 years, some more than that, and why it is that after all of that time, we're still having this conversation, and why it is that sometimes the conversation seems so similar and so familiar, and we don't seem to make the kind of progress that we seek to make. And everywhere I go, particularly if it's someplace to which I have been before, people ask very similar questions. And when you do this kind of work, the kind of questions they will ask you will be, number one, you know, how did you get into this work and why? And you know, the answer to that is the book White Like Me, which you all were talking about a second ago, and apparently many of you have read. And then the other question is, how do you maintain hope in difficult times like this? And my answer is one that usually catches people off guard. The answer is, I don't. I don't maintain hope in times like this, because hope is not the same as commitment. And hope is not the same as action. And hope is not the same as mobilization. Hope is something completely devoid of agency. You see, I have two daughters. They are 18 and 16. And since we are in a church, I invite you to say a prayer for my wife and I, having told you that we have two daughters who are 18 and 16. And both of our kids drive, right? And when they go out driving somewhere, they go out with their friends. They drive to school. They drive to their dance studio. You know, I hope that they make it home okay. I really do. But I have no control over that whatsoever. We've taught them how to drive. We've worked with them on driving and learning the rules of the road. But beyond that, I really have no control over what happens when my kids get behind the wheel of the car. I am helpless in that situation, though hopeful, right? I'm going to fly home tomorrow from San Francisco to Nashville after being on the road for 2 weeks. And I really hope I make it. I hope I do, but I don't know how to fly a plane. Indeed, I don't even really understand aviation at all. I think it might be witchcraft because I didn't pay attention in science, so I have absolutely no idea how it works. I mean, it doesn't make sense to me, right? But I hope it doesn't crash, and I hope that you hope, for my sake, that it doesn't as well. But I have no control over it, so to hope for a safe flight or to hope for my kids' safe return when they've been out driving doesn't do much, right? And if all we do is hope for justice in unjust times, we're doing nothing better than hoping for the safe return of our children in the car or the safe passage of ourselves in a jet airliner from one spot to another. We have to maintain commitment, not hope. Hope is not helpful in these times. Commitment might be. And that isn't hard to maintain at all. Because really, there isn't any alternative to that. I mean, there is, but it's ghastly to contemplate. And if you need a reminder as to why we must maintain commitment and how we can be inspired to do so, all you have to do, and if you haven't had a chance to do it yet, I highly recommend that you do so, is to go to Washington, D.C. when you get a chance and walk through the relatively recently opened Museum of African American History and Culture. If you need a reminder of what it is to remain committed even in oppressive and unjust times, it is an incredible place to go and to spend several hours. You can spend the whole day there and probably not see everything that there is to see. It's an incredibly powerful exhibition. Emmett Till's original casket is there. Nat Turner's Bible is there. And when you go through the museum, there's this one part where you see this statue. It's a statue of Thomas Jefferson, and it's sort of shrouded in shadows, and behind the statue of Jefferson is a big granite wall, and it's lit up, and carved into the wall are his most famous words, you know the ones, that all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, among these life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And in between that granite wall and the statue of Jefferson, actually right behind Jefferson, also shrouded in shadows, is another wall. It's a brick wall. I don't think it's actually made of bricks. It is probably paper mache, but it is made to look as if it were bricks. And on each brick is a name. And as you look at the wall, you won't necessarily know what the names on the bricks represent, or perhaps you will, but if you don't, and if you cannot figure it out, there are docents who I'm sure will fill you in short order, and let you know that the names on the bricks are the names of the human beings that Jefferson owned right up until his death, and certainly at the time that he wrote those pretty words that all men were created equal, a comment he made while clearly not meaning it. And the contrast between the promise and the reality that Jefferson and others like him gave this country, the difference, the gap between aspiration and achievement is stark, but in that moment you are reminded of something. And it's something that speaks to this issue of how one maintains commitment in difficult times. You are reminded that Thomas Jefferson and the system that those like Thomas Jefferson defended, created, established, and maintained, they are dead. And black and brown peoples are still very much alive. And then you continue to walk through the museum and you see the images of George Wallace in the schoolhouse door in Alabama in 1963, and Bull Connor turning dogs and tanks on children in Birmingham in 1963, and Sheriff Jim Clark and his goons on the Edmund Pettus Bridge beating civil rights protesters in Selma in 1965. And you are reminded in that moment, even in those darkest moments of the movement, you are reminded that Jim Clark is dead and Bull Connor is dead and George Wallace is dead and black and brown people are still very much alive. And if you need any more reason to remain committed than that, I don't know that I can help you tonight. And I'm not sure what it is that would allow you to maintain commitment. We have absolutely no alternative but to maintain it. And if they could do so, even in the midst of those darkest and most oppressive days of segregation, and even before that, during the oppressive days of enslavement and the indigenous genocide that took place on this continent, if peoples of color did not give up, and if their white allies and Confederates, not as in Southern Confederates, but you understand, Confederates as in solidarity with you, if they could maintain commitment even in those moments, who in the world are we not to? And to act as if we have some alternative route that we might take. You see, it isn't that hard to maintain commitment, but it can be hard to maintain focus. So I want to talk a little bit about that. Because I think, I'm fairly confident, that one of our biggest problems is that we continue to misunderstand the thing that we're up against. And we have contented ourselves, particularly those of us who consider ourselves liberal or progressive or left, right? We have contented ourselves with the idea that this problem of racism is a problem of those people over there, so it is a problem of David Duke, whose name you heard conjured earlier, right? Or it is a problem of overt white supremacist neo-Nazis or those boys in Charlottesville that marched around in 2017 with tiki torches yelling blood and soil and Jews will not replace us, right? Because it's easy, isn't it, to draw a line at those people and say these are the bad people and we are the good people and we are not like them and therefore we are not part of the problem. And if we could just deal with those people, or if we could just vote one man out of office, all of this unpleasantness, you know, would go away. But there's something incredibly disingenuous and even evil about that mentality, because it elides the way in which we are all implicated in the racial inequality that continues to plague this country. There are so many ways in which that is true. And when you look around and you see what the evidence tells us, right? The evidence tells us in no uncertain terms that the typical white family in this country, for instance, has 15 times the net worth of the typical black family, 11 to 12 times the net worth of the typical Latinx family. Now, that is not the fault of David Duke. And that is not the fault of the Klan. And that is not the fault of Donald Trump. Those things existed before Trump. They're going to exist after Trump. They have existed in administrations, both Democratic and Republican, for generations. Why? Because we collectively have not done enough to ensure that our leaders take those issues seriously enough to campaign on them and to make commitments to changing them. In fact, the typical white household headed by a high school dropout, hear me now, the typical white household headed by a high school dropout has one-third more wealth than the typical black household headed by a college graduate. So That can't be the fault of David Duke. That's not Nazis. That's not Klansmen. That's not those boys in Charlottesville. That's us. That is the collective legacy of race and racism in this country, about which we all must be concerned and within which we are all embedded, right? And for which we are all implicated. Black folks with college degrees almost twice as likely as whites with degrees to be unemployed, even when the majors are the same and the degrees are the same. Latinx folks with degrees 50% more likely than comparable whites to be unemployed. Our indigenous brothers and sisters 2/3 more likely than whites with degrees to be unemployed. Asian Americans with degrees 20% more likely than whites with degrees to be unemployed. So the question becomes, who is that on? I would say it's on all of us. And especially because everything about this culture has trained every last one of us at some remove to accept a degree of inequality which we wouldn't accept if we were critically assessing that culture better than we tend to do. We're all implicated in it because we're all taught the same thing. And we walk away with the lessons of that teaching. See, we're all products of our learning. And sometimes if we aren't learning what we need to learn, right, it becomes very easy to fall back on assumptions that are themselves racist, to internalize bias oneself just by walking around in a society that doesn't explain to you what it is you're seeing. If you don't have an understanding of how we got from point A to point B to point C, then when you try to assess point C, you won't understand the predicate to it and you won't have any idea how to work your way out of it. And I started thinking about this not as a scholar and not as an activist or an author, but as a father. Right? Because as a parent, you're always sort of paying attention to how your kids learn things, right? You just notice when the light bulbs come on, right? It can be a very powerful kind of thing. And so several years ago, I was driving my daughters one day when they were 12 and 10, or as the kids like to say, 12 and a half and 10 and a half. Because they like to feel a little bit older than they really are, right? Was driving them from school to the dance studio where they were both in company. They're both dancers, both company dancers. And this particular company in which they found themselves was about an 8-minute drive on surface roads from their school. And one day we're about 4 minutes in, about halfway between the school and the studio on a route that we've driven 3 days a week, every week for probably a year at that point. So it's not like we don't do this all the time. But on this particular day, something happened that was different. We got stopped at a red light halfway between the school and the studio in downtown Nashville. And as we're waiting for the light to turn, my youngest daughter, Rachel, who was 10 at the time in the back seat, starts looking around. This red light happens to be in the middle of a public housing community just down the road from their school. And again, it's a red light. I'm sure we have been stopped at many times, but at no other point on any other day has my child taken note of the neighborhood, looked around, and commented on it. And that day she did. She said, "Daddy, why is it that this neighborhood is pretty much all black?" And I thought, well, now that is an excellent question. I was really excited for two reasons. Number one, my kid at the age of 10 was doing urban anthropology in the back of my Highlander. So that's pretty good stuff. That's like early admission to college stuff, right? That's like, my God, so observant. Let's get you into school now and get this over with, right? But let's be honest. The reason I was truly excited was because that's like the one question that my kid could ask me that I actually know the answer to, right? That's actually what daddy knows about. Like if you ask me, child of mine, where electricity comes from, my answer would not be nearly as good. It would be something along the lines of, you take science, don't you? Or you have a phone, why don't you Google it? Or I would do that thing that parents do when we don't know the answer, but we don't want to let our kids know about our own ignorance. And so, you know, the universal parental sign when that happens is, I don't know, what do you think? That's what we say when we don't have a clue, but we don't want the kid to know that we don't have a clue. I would have done that over any other question, but my kid asked the one thing I know about, the racial dynamic of a community. Daddy's got that. And I was excited, right? Because I was going to get to show off my brilliance to my kids. And parents, you know, you got to take your victories where you can find them, and you don't find them all that often, right? So I was ready. I had the answer. Now, I couldn't give the PhD answer. Number one, I do not have a PhD. Number two, we had 4 minutes left, so it wasn't enough time for the PhD answer, and number three, the kids are 10 and 12, so right? It's only so much I can do, but I knew I could give the thumbnail sketch, the age-appropriate explanation, so I had the answer. I'm ready with the elevator speech about the way that the neighborhood came to look, the way the neighborhood came to look, and then something happened, and it was something I didn't know was going to happen because I'm an only child. But apparently, come to realize that day, that when a younger sibling asks a question of a parent in the presence of an older sibling, inevitably, and without very much delay, the older sibling will just answer the damn question themselves, just to show off how much smarter they are than the younger kid. So remember the 10-year-old's question, Daddy, why is this neighborhood pretty much all black? Daddy knows, Daddy has the answer. It's caught right here in my throat, ready to break free. The 12-year-old sitting in the front seat hears the question, jumps in and says, redlining. And I was like, what? What was that? Did your mother give birth to a sociological savant? What was that? Do you just know things? And the 10-year-old said, well, Daddy, I don't know what redlining means. I said, your sister doesn't know what redlining means. But that was a really good guess. Now, actually, and let's be honest, it's not quite right. Redlining is not actually how the neighborhood got black. It is how it got and remained poor, right? Because redlining was a practice of under- and decapitalization, banks refusing to lend within the boundaries of the red lines that they would draw on maps in the bank loan offices, so that if you were black, and occasionally in some Puerto Rican neighborhoods in New York as well and elsewhere, but especially black, you were going to be deprived of capital, of financing for a mortgage or a business. And it went on legally for generations. Still happens indirectly, but it was perfectly legal for several generations, and that is how the neighborhood got poor, but it's not how it got black. But you know what? My kid's 12, so I'm going to give her partial credit, and we're going to just let her retake the test. We're going to start her out with 50 points, and she can work on the next 50. It's still reasonably impressive for her to have any sense of that at all, and I had the 4 minutes now to give her the thumbnail sketch, so I did. I said, well, here's the thing. I said, you know, most people don't know, but it's worth noting, right, that public housing, the place that we were, which we now so often associate with people of color, because disproportionately people of color will be found living in public housing and or subsidized housing communities. But it wasn't set up for black and brown folks, right? It was set up for white folks specifically. In fact, black and brown folks were usually barred from even living in those communities. So this was set up for the white poor and working class in the midst of the Depression. At the same time, the government also did what? They created some additional efforts. The FHA loan program, later on the VA loans, later on the GI Bill, theoretically open to everyone, or in the case of the VA and GI Bill, at least returning veterans. But in practice, overwhelmingly, these benefits were restricted to white folks. And so white folks were able to hustle it out of the cities and go into the suburbs with these government-guaranteed and backed loans, suburbs where only we could live and from which people of color were routinely blocked. And so in a sense, the government directly subsidized white flight throughout the 1940s and the 1950s and into the early 1960s, leaving black and brown folks behind, at which point redlining then undercapitalizes the community and maintains it as poor space. So I tell that story, very brief thumbnail sketch. I get to the studio, I drop them off. I ask them if they understand what I'm saying. They seemed appropriately horrified, so I felt I had done my job. And as I pulled away, I felt pretty good about myself, except after I got a couple of blocks, I had this wave of terror come over me. And the wave of terror was because I realized in that moment that the only thing that allowed me to feel good about that moment was that I happened to know the answer to the question because I happened to work in this field and have studied that. But how many parents wouldn't know the answer? And then what happens? Right? Especially white parents. Like black and brown folks tend to know that history because it's their story. They lived through it. So they know it firsthand, but how many white folks wouldn't even know enough about that history to tell their children? And if we don't know enough to tell our children, or the teachers of our kids don't know enough to teach our children these things, what do you think happens? Do they stop wondering? No. They keep wondering, but then they start filling in the blanks themselves. They come up with their own answers. And what's the answer they're going to come up with? If they don't have the historical background, if they aren't given the sociological imagination to make sense of what they see, they will come up with their own conclusion, and the only one that they can reach in this culture is the one that we were all given, the one that we've all been taught to explain why some are here and some are here. And you all know what that explanation is. It's the one thing we were all taught. Doesn't matter what your race or ethnic background, cultural background, religious background, geographic background of your origin. If you were born and reared in this country, or even if you were born elsewhere, immigrated here and have lived here more than a minute, you know that the one thing we were all taught was what? It is the building block. It is the secular gospel of our ideology. If America were a Bible, it would be Genesis 1:1. You know what it is. It is the idea that wherever you end up is all about you, and that anybody can make it in America. That is the fundamental principle to which this country insists we all cleave. That anybody can make it in America. Now, we are told that, and we tend to believe it, at least in part, even though we know it's nonsense. And we do know it's nonsense, don't we? I mean, we all know people who've worked hard every day and have nothing to show for it. We know other people who were born on third base, think they hit a triple, never had to work hard a day in their lives. I'm even told, though it may be a vicious rumor, that there are some people in this country who managed to inherit, over the course of their 70-plus years, $400 million worth of cash and real estate from their daddies and still want you to believe they're self-made billionaires. I will leave it to your imagination to figure out who in the world I might be speaking of. So we all know that this is a myth, and that's putting it lightly. It's actually more than that. It's a lie, this notion of rugged individualism and meritocracy. There's no such thing as a rugged individual. There's no such thing as an individual abstracted from their social context. Humans are social creatures. None of us were raised on an island by a porpoise, right? If you ever, in fact, do encounter someone who qualifies as a rugged individual, can I just give you a piece of advice? You need to get the hell away from that thing, okay? Because it's going to be dangerous. It's not going to have language. It's going to be feral. Nobody would have ever taught it about that whole thing that you're not supposed to eat other people. So you might want to run, right? There are no such thing. We've all had help. We've all had people in our lives who've come into our lives and explain how it is that we got from point A to point B. Our society is not the result of rugged individuals making choices and just simply bumping into one another. It's about systems and structures. But if my child doesn't have a parent who can instruct her on that, my child is going to default to the idea that, well, I guess these people are just better. I guess the reason they live over here is because they're worse. And I guess the reason they live like this is because they don't work as hard. Or maybe their values are not as strong, right? So all of a sudden, racism ends up becoming rational if you don't know the history and the sociological context. Classism becomes rational. Well, the rich just must be smarter. They just must work harder. And poor people must be lazy. Sexism becomes rational. Right? Well, I guess men just must be go-getters and women just must not want careers as badly or must not be as capable of doing certain jobs and exercising leadership. Inequality becomes rational unless you interrogate the core mythology of America. And that core mythology of America was not invented by David Duke, and it was not invented by those boys in Charlottesville, and it was not invented by Donald Trump. It has been here from the beginning, and we all imbibe it, so it's on us. You see? It's on all of us. This is not a problem where we can simply draw a line and put ourselves on the good side of it and the other folks on the bad. We are all implicated in this thing, right? And part of our implication also has to do, and it goes back to this issue of historical memory. It goes back to the way in which we either remember or misremember things, right? Because so much of our ability to misdiagnose the problem or to flag perhaps in our commitment or to feel burned out or to not know what direction in which we need to go is connected to our persistent lack of historical memory. It's what gets us in trouble time and time again. All of our current divisions, the deepest divisions we have in this country, are fundamentally about that. They're about our inability to grapple consistently or effectively or ethically with our past and how the past has brought us to the present. Every one of our current deep divisions is about that. Think about it for a minute. Think about the divide that exists in this country over the issue of law enforcement misconduct in black and brown communities. Why is this so divisive? It is fundamentally divisive because most of white America has absolutely no conception of the history of law enforcement in black and brown space and how it differs from the history of law enforcement in white space. Black and brown peoples have no choice but to understand some of that history. Again, they have lived it. Law enforcement traces directly to slave patrols. That is the first iteration of policing in this country, but we are not taught that. That is not something that we tend to discuss in white homes and in mostly white institutions of education. But black folks know, for instance, that it was cops who enforced the black codes. It was cops who enforced segregation. It was cops that pulled sit-in protesters off of stools in Greensboro and Nashville and all throughout the South. It was cops who have enforced the war on drugs, which I beg to remind you is, of course, not a war on drugs. Because if it were a war on drugs, I'm not sure who would be giving this lecture to you this evening, but I am fairly confident it would not be me. And I can tell you that now because the statute of limitations has expired on this stuff, and they cannot touch me. The war on drugs has never been about drugs. White folks are statistically just as likely to use, possess, and even sell illegal narcotics, but of course some bear the brunt of that enforcement, others not so much. And people of color are acutely aware of this, right? But to be white is to not necessarily know that history. And when black folks are aware of that, and as a result insist that they must say Black Lives Matter, the reason that so much of white America cannot get our head around that is because we do not understand just how much black life has been devalued within the systems of law enforcement. If we understood that, nothing about that slogan would be radical. It wouldn't get us twisted up and bent out of shape. We wouldn't respond by saying all lives matter. We would never utter such nonsense. We know, for instance, that white lives matter as well, but so do all the cops, and so do all the teachers, and so do all the employers, and so do all the bank loan officers, and so do all the clerks at the mall who don't follow my white daughters around on the assumption that they're going to shoplift or be up to no good. You don't have to say that white life matters. It is taken for granted. You don't have to say all. It is taken for granted. The problem being that in America, we've said all for a very long time while not meaning it. I already gave you the Jefferson quote, but let me remind, all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. Among these, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, words written by a man who owned 237 human beings at the time that he set quill to paper. So he did not mean it, but he said it, right? The Pledge of Allegiance, same thing, right? The last line of the pledge. There's been three different, at least, iterations of the pledge. The first was in the 1880s, and then it was done again in the 20s, and it was finalized in the 50s. But the last line has always been the same, with liberty and justice for whom? For all. There it is again. But I don't think it's controversial for me to suggest that at no point in the 1880s, the 1920s, or the 1950s did those who said that at the end of the pledge really mean it in any substantive way. So until all actually means all, we're just going to have to understand why black folks insist on specifying that which has been left out. But see, if we understood the history, nothing that I just said would be weird, right? It would just be so obvious as to almost be banal. But it's simply the fact that we haven't learned the history that makes it so hard for us to understand why people of color view the issue differently. And don't start from the same premise that law enforcement is always on the side of the angels and should be trusted, right? Again, historical memory. It's vital to addressing some of our deepest divisions. Immigration, easily an even better example of this, right? Why are we so divided over the issue of immigration? I would suggest, again, it has to do with a profound misunderstanding of our history. Beginning with the rhetoric you hear regularly from those who say, well, you know, I don't mind if they come, right? I just want them to come the right way, legally, like my ancestors did. What the hell does that even mean, y'all? Legally, like your ancestors, when your ancestors and mine, that is to say those of us who were white, came to this country, there were no laws to break. So when your great, great, great whatever comes legally to a country where there was no law they could have even theoretically broken in order to do the deed, they don't get patted on the back for their law abidingness. If you don't break a law that doesn't even exist, you don't get a trophy for your magnanimity. You don't get applauded for having been so gosh darn honest. Right? But we say it, and then we say other things too, like, Donald Trump did when he announced his presidency. What did he say? He said, Mexico, they're not sending their best. Okay, again, historical memory, y'all. Do you think England sent their best? Do you actually think England sent their best? Because I'm fairly confident they didn't. The best never leave, y'all. The best never get on the boat. The best are winning right where they are. There is no need to leave. The winners never leave. The winners stay. Why? Because they're winning. Winning feels good. Why would you strike out on the high seas, take a chance on dying, getting scurvy, hijacked by pirates, capsizing in a boat, and starving to death when you were doing fine back home? I'm always fascinated when white people tell me that their ancestors came over on the Mayflower. Okay, you might not want to brag about that if you actually knew who was on that ship and the other ships that came around that time, because I can assure you who wasn't: the king. The king was not on the Mayflower. Neither was anybody the king particularly wanted to keep around. The boats that came in those days were principally filled with those who could not make it. They were the losers of Europe. And I'm not saying that to be mean. I just need to remind y'all, because the president keeps talking about shithole countries as if he's never read Dickens, which I'm sure he hasn't, but I assume you have. These were the losers of Europe, and there's no shame in that. I'm not saying that to be pejorative. I'm not saying that to be cruel. I'm saying it because we need a reminder. We act like somehow our people came here with advanced mathematical computational abilities and clean fingernails. Right? We were the losers of Europe. That's why we left. And there's no shame in it. In fact, you know what? There's something beautiful about it. There's something beautiful about being the losers of Europe or the losers of anywhere and saying, you know what? I'm tired of losing. I'm tired of being oppressed. I'm tired of being stepped on. I'm tired of watching my children starve. I'm going to start over again. But if that's beautiful when English folks do it, and that's beautiful when Irish folks do it, and that's beautiful when Italian folks do it, and it's beautiful when Russian Jews do it, it's also beautiful when folks in El Salvador do it, and Honduras do it, and Mexico do it, and Sri Lanka do it, and all throughout the continent of Africa do it. But our lack of historical memory tells us that we don't have to think about it that way. We don't have to see ourselves in them, and we don't have to see them in us, right? Because we've drawn this line of humanity right down the middle and said, well, they're coming for different reasons. You know, our people came for principles like liberty and freedom, and they're just coming for stuff. Look, y'all, we came for stuff, okay? Stuff like land, stuff like the ability not to be killed or further oppressed. That's stuff too. It's not some high-minded principle. You think we actually came here to establish liberty? If so, it sure is interesting. It took us an awful long time to establish it, right? Like, the colonies were not a free place. They were not a liberty-filled place. They were not a particularly conducive place for these high-minded principles. The colonies were basically a place where we were murdering indigenous people, enslaving African people, and looking for the witch. None of that is about liberty, right? We didn't come for principle, we came for stuff. And again, there's nothing wrong with it. Nobody really likes to move, right? That's the thing we forget. We act like these folks that are coming from south of this fictive border that was the result of war and conquest, we act as if the people who are coming from there are just doing it because they have nothing better to do. Like, oh, it's a Wednesday and I have no appointments on my calendar. I think I'll just pack all my stuff up and move 3 countries away where I will be hunted and hated and possibly deported. Give up my culture, give up my family, give up my language. Why would anyone do that? Nobody likes to move. My wife and I built a new house 8 years ago. It is 3 blocks from our old house, y'all. And it damn near killed me, right? 3 blocks. We didn't change zip codes. We didn't change voting precinct. We had the same mail carrier, and it damn near killed me. I told my wife, I'm like, if we ever have grandchildren, it is to this house that they will come. When I die, you will carry me out of here feet first. I will never do this again. That was 3 blocks, right? Now magnify that, not by 3 blocks or by 3 cities or by 3 states, but by countries. Nobody would do that for, you know, shits and giggles, as the saying goes. You would only do that as an act of desperation. But why is it that we can't see ourselves in the other? Why? Because our historical memory is so blinkered, so inaccurate. We've taught it so badly, right? It's one of the reasons that I've been going around lately. I'm talking to teachers a lot, you know, and I'm I'm noticing, and you've probably noticed it too, there's this big emphasis on STEM education, right? Which stands for science, technology, engineering, and math. And look, that stuff's important. Don't get me wrong. Like science, if we're going to pull out of the ecological crisis that we face, we're going to need good scientists, no doubt about that. Technology can be very helpful, obviously, in any number of ways. Engineers, love them. I like it when roads and bridges don't collapse, so that's awesome. And math, you know, I'm glad some of y'all like it. I knew it wasn't going to be this guy, but somebody's got to do it. And if you're one of them, God bless you and good luck. I just knew it wasn't going to be me. But here's the problem. We have all this emphasis on STEM, and I get a little nervous. I worry that in this push for STEM, we're forgetting something, that we could 20 or 30 years from now be very technologically advanced, even more so than we are. We could have a lot of tech bros and maybe some tech gals if we truly open up STEM to women. And we might have more people of color in STEM, which would be nice because they certainly have often been excluded from full opportunity in those fields. But what if we get 20 or 30 years out and we have all these great computer programmers and people who can code, but we don't have the capacity to function as citizens of a pluralistic, multicultural democracy because we haven't taken care of our civics education? You see, we can have very highly advanced, technologically, mathematically advanced people who are not capable of maintaining a democracy because technology can be used to liberate or it can be used to oppress, right? And in fact, science historically has been weaponized against the weakest, right? It has been used as a tool of marginalization, even genocide. Those things that the Nazis did in Germany and throughout the period of World War II to create a master race and to exterminate those they viewed as inferior, none of those were born from the mind of Adolf Hitler or any of his associates. They were born in laboratories in this country, created by the best and brightest minds ensconced in academic jobs at Stanford and Yale and Harvard and Princeton and Columbia. Those were our scientists who came up with the sterilization programs that people like Josef Mengele implemented during World War II. Our scientists. So we can't just do STEM as some abstract thing. We have to remember the importance of teaching STEM with an eye toward the kind of society that we want to have, which is why we need something beyond STEM. I call it MESH education, M-E-S-H, M for media literacy, E for ethics, S for sociology, H for history. Think about this. We live in a time when young people are being bombarded with more media imagery than any generation before them, having to figure out how to sift through it, right, to separate the wheat from the chaff. We don't talk about that very much in school, though. We don't provide them with the tools or allow them to develop the tools to better analyze that medium bombardment. And I'm not just talking about news media and political media. I mean even the media of commercial culture, right, the way that corporations are constantly bombarding them with messages of consumption and materialism and buy this and buy that. Young people need to have the skills to be able to sift through that, but media literacy is not being taught. Ethics. How many of us have taken classes on ethics, even though all of the things that we face as a country and as a planet involve ethical dilemmas and trade-offs and figuring out how to work through those? But unless you're a philosophy major, which is like, you know, 11 people or something, right? Or unless maybe you have those conversations in your house of worship, right? Most of us don't engage in these sort of ethical discussions, but we need to. We need to think about philosophy and ethics as important things, but we're not teaching that. Sociology, the S. If people don't have a sociological imagination, understanding the power dynamics of institutions and groups in a society, which is what sociology affords us, is knowledge about that. If we don't have that, we cannot make sense of things like the inequality about which I was speaking before. And so we end up coming to conclusions that end up rationalizing and thus maintaining that inequality. And history, the H, which we teach so miserably in our country. And you know this is true. There are more people in this country who grow up believing that silly story we were all taught about George Washington. You know the story that I'm talking about. It's that one about little George, you know, chopping down that cherry tree. And he was just so gosh darn honest that he went to his daddy and said, "Daddy, daddy, daddy, I did it. I did it. I chopped down the tree, daddy, and I cannot tell a lie." Well, apparently the historians had no such compunction because that story is a lie. It did not happen. No actual historian has ever documented that story. It is a falsehood, right? But more kids grow up learning that story than knowing about George Washington owning other human beings and being a particularly vicious slave owner. Not that any of them were good, but he was particularly vicious as a slave owner, and people don't know that. Why? Because we'd rather teach the first rather than the latter, because the first allows us to maintain this fiction that the founders were virtual deities of such moral rectitude and perfection that we must always look up to them without exception and without complication. So we need better history education as well, mesh just as much as STEM. Because our historical memory is one of the reasons that I think we're not only at each other's throats about policing and about immigration, any number of other subjects, but it's one of the reasons we can't quite understand what's happening in our country right now. Several years ago, after the election of Donald Trump, you know, you heard this a lot. You heard it from white people. You didn't hear black folks do this very often. You didn't hear too many people of color generally do it. But you heard a lot of white folks who seemed stunned at the election of Donald Trump. I don't think that many black folks were stunned. Right? Black folks might have been, you know, upset, maybe not happy, but they weren't shocked that America might elect Donald Trump as president of the United States. It wasn't something outside the realm of the possible, let's just say that, right? But a lot of white folks, particularly nice white liberals, man, we were just all in our feelings in all kinds of weird kind of ways about this. It was just sort of like, my God, how could this happen? This is unprecedented. This is not the America that we know. For real, what America do you know? Right? Because the America that black and brown folks know is precisely the America that would make Donald Trump president of the United States. Why? Because here's a rich white man telling not rich white people that their enemies are black and brown. That's not new. That's the oldest play in the playbook. Like, literally, if there were a playbook of American politics, that is like the first play on the first page. And you know, when Donald Trump opened up that book, not being a big reader, he looked at play one. He was like, bam, I'm going to go with that one. Why would I even read further? That one seems to work, and it does. But if we don't have the historical memory around that, then we get all knocked off stride, and we think this is some kind of weird thing that doesn't make sense. It's 400 years old. It makes perfect sense. And if we'd known it, we could have been prepared for it. What is that history? We got to understand this, right? This is not an academic lecture, but this is an important point that has both academic and practical application, right? Rich white men telling not rich white people that their enemies are black and brown goes back to the colonies when whiteness was created, keeping in mind now that there is no such thing as the white race. It wasn't what we called ourselves in Europe. The history of Europe was not the history of one big happy family getting along, right? The English hated the Irish hated them back. Most everybody hated the Germans, often with cause, I should point out. The northern Italians didn't even think the southern Italians were Italian. Thought that they were a Mediterranean or even North African peoples, right? The history of Europe's a history of killing each other until we figured out there were other people to kill. So we were not one big happy family. There was no pan-European unity, right? But all of a sudden, in the colonies of what would become the United States, this term and this concept of the white race becomes a thing. Now, what happened? Why is it that all of a sudden in the 17th century, we have this new thing called the white race? Was there some kind of anthropological discovery? Was there an archaeological dig beneath Stonehenge where they suddenly found, oh my God, we are all connected to all of these other brothers and sisters of Europe? No, there was no dig. There was no discovery. There was no new science. There was no linguistic development showing some pan-European unity. The only thing that happened was that the rich landowners in the colonies of what would become the United States looked around, did some math, and realized they were outnumbered. That's it. And when they realized they were outnumbered by African enslaved folks and European indentured servants who were just one level above enslaved themselves, right? They decided that the only way they could maintain their power was to divide and conquer these working class, piss poor Europeans and Africans who were essentially peasants and or slaves to keep them from rising up and taking their stuff. Because every now and then there were rebellions, right? You had Bacon's Rebellion in 1676, several others. where these poor folks across lines of color joined together to overthrow aristocratic government. And the rich were nervous. So what do? They create the notion of whiteness as a way to say to even the poorest European that you're on our team. You have more in common with us than with those folks who you live around and who you work around and who we exploit just like we exploit you. Now you're on our team, and we're gonna make you part of the team by getting rid of indentured servitude. See, no more of that. And we're going to put you on the slave patrol. You can help us keep those folks in line. See, now we're going to give you a little taste of power. Not much, not much. We don't like you that much. But we're going to give you just a little power, right? Give you a taste of it and remind you that no matter how lowly you may be, you're always above somebody. It's what W.E.B. Du Bois would later call the psychological wage of whiteness. I may not have much, but at least I'm better than you. Meaning that person who is black, that person who is brown, that person who is anything but called white. And all of a sudden, whiteness so created, those rebellions begin to stop. And those cross-racial, cross-color coalitions disintegrate. And white supremacy takes root, rich white people telling not rich white people that their enemies are black and brown. Fast forward to the Civil War era, and my people in the South, the rich in the South, right, they start telling the poor in the South the same kind of thing, right? The rich make it very clear that the purpose for secession, we lie about it now, but we used to be honest because we weren't ashamed, right? We made it very clear at the time the reason we wanted to break away from the Union was the maintenance of enslavement and white supremacy. It is what the vice president of the Confederacy, Alexander Stevens, called the cornerstone of the new government, the idea that the Negro is not the equal of the white man. His words, not mine. He wasn't talking about states' rights in the abstract. He wasn't talking about trade and tariff policy. He was talking about the ownership, as was the Confederacy as a whole, the ownership of other human beings. It was the only reason for which they sought to leave the Union and even go to war and sent hundreds of thousands of their brothers and nephews and uncles and fathers and sons to die. And yet the trick is the rich don't want to go to war. The rich never go to war. Rich people get doctors to write notes saying they have heel spurs so they don't have to go to war. That is what rich people do, right? And so the rich had no intention of fighting for their own property, even though they made it clear their property interest was the only reason for which the fight would be had. So they had to get poor people to do it. How do you do that? You tell them, as they did, if these black people get free, they're going to take your job. And the white working class folks, oh my God, take my job. No, fool, they already have your job. Are you paying attention? Clearly not, right? Because if you're white and you have to charge $1 a day to work on the farm or whatever, but the owner can get the black person to do it for free because they own them as property, guess who got the job? Free got the job. Folks like free, right? Free will undercut that $1 a day every day, all day, every week, all year, right? And so in a very real sense, the slave system undermined the labor interest of working class white people who would have been better off joining together with African enslaved people to overthrow the system of aristocracy and take all the rich folks' stuff. But the psychological wage of whiteness said you must maintain your betterness than somebody, that somebody is these people, so we would like you to go fight and die for our way of life. And these folks lined up to do it because they believed that one day they just worked really hard, they would own somebody too, and they would have property to divide and conquer. And now we fast forward into this current moment, and that's what the immigration debate is about as well. A rich white man telling not rich white people that their enemies are black and brown. If we can just build this wall, everything will be fine. We can just build this wall, the jobs will come back. That's not how capitalism works, right? You build a wall and you don't let labor move, but capital still moves. The boss can still relocate the factory in Sri Lanka to take advantage of lower wages and no labor unions and no environmental laws. The capital will still cross borders. The goods will still cross borders. If capital can move and goods can move, but labor can't move, you have skewed the game inalterably against working people and in favor of owners. That's just Econ 101. And not just the workers who are brown, but even workers on this side of the border who would be better off in a larger, more militant working class, demanding equity, opportunity, better jobs and benefits for all working people on the continent. But divide and conquer says we don't have to think about that. See, this is why history is more than just something we need to learn because the state tells us to. You know, we have history standards, right, that every state has. You have to have so many years of this kind of education. But it's not just some perfunctory requirement, right? It's something without which we cannot make sense of what is happening in our world. We cannot make sense of what is happening in our country. We leave our children adrift, right? Unable to process the politics and the moment that we find ourselves in. We find ourselves unable to get a hold of our own anxieties around what's going on because it seems so new. It seems so frightening. People think it's unique, but it's not. If you understand that it's not, that's empowering. I mean, it's frightening. Because you start to realize, my God, this is a trick that's worked for 400 years. It's a hell of a trick, right? But it's important when you understand the trick, see? This is why magicians never tell you the secret of their trick, right? Because once they tell you the secret, it doesn't work on you anymore. Now it's like, oh, I know what you did. You know, you had the card in your sleeve. I know this trick. This is stupid. I'm not going to pay to see this again, right? This is a trick that's worked for 400 years, and when you understand how it works, it becomes possible to figure out how to stop it from working and how to call it out and how to expose the magician for all to see. See, when you think that the monster you're facing is new, it's really scary. I remember when I was a kid, I used to have a superpower. Wasn't a great one. I mean, it was all right. Wasn't the one I wished I had. You know, I wanted to fly. Couldn't do that. Wanted to be able to see through walls. Couldn't do that, right? Wanted to have cloak of invisibility. Yeah, I didn't have that either, right? But I had this one really interesting superpower. I could get out of nightmares, which is good when you're a kid, right? Because sometimes you have nightmares and they're scary and getting out of them is a good thing. I had this method whenever I was being chased by a monster, right? I would just blink my eyes really, really hard. I could look at the monster and I would just go like that, blink really hard, and I would be awake. And it always worked except on those rare occasions when the monster was new, right? When the monster was a monster with which I was not familiar, sometimes I might have to blink three times. And sometimes even that wouldn't work. Sometimes I would just have to go hide until the monster had passed. But then the next night, if that monster came back, the blink would work, right? What's the point of me telling you that? The point is this. When you know the monster and you realize it's the same monster that you've been running from for years, for decades, for centuries, for generations, you don't have to be paralyzed by it. And this monster that we are fighting is the same monster that has been under the bed for 400 years, the same monster that has been in the closet for 400 years. And when you know that, it frees you to strategize to fight back, just as those persons whose stories are chronicled in that museum in Washington fought back. And if they could do it, we could do it. And if George Wallace could not, and if Jim Clark could not, and if Bull Connor could not, and if Thomas Jefferson could not stop black and brown folks on the march to freedom, I am fairly confident that Donald John Trump is not the one, y'all. Thank you very much for being here. I appreciate you. And thank you. Thank you. And I will be glad to take questions that you might have. I think we have a mic we can bring to you, perhaps.
Well, we're
acoustics
going
in here are great. We might not need it, but
well, it's really good to have. Thank you, Tim.
You bet. Thank you.
We're going to line up here. I'm going to hand you the mic, and we're going to ask Tim Wise a question. And we're not going to speechify. We're not going to you. We're not going to fawn. Okay, 2 seconds of fawning on Tim, but that's it. Okay, so we get directly to our question. Can we get some people to line up? I know that it's a lot of questions are going on in our minds. So and if nobody stands up, you, sir, are going to be the first one. Oh, thank you.
And if you're physically not able to get to the mic, we'll bring
you,
it to
thank
you.
Thank you.
So just know anyone who, because I know sometimes there are people in the audience that don't. Either can't thank get up or sometimes you just don't like to. So we'll get you a mic if you need it. Yes.
Thank you so much for your talk.
You bet.
And I was intrigued. Is that okay? Can you hear me?
Yeah, that's great.
The point that you made about education, I taught all my life. And when you're talking about the lack of principles that educators should have in transmitting what you're hoping they will transmit, how can you change, you know, from the bottom up? Because the it's so entrenched.
Yeah.
The curriculum is sort of set in stone. You have to, get people really angry before they'll go to bat for a change in curriculum. So I'm interested in that.
Well, that's, I mean, our movements for education reform have to include this, and so often they don't. You know, what we end up doing when we talk about educational reform, progressive, because that term means a lot to a lot of people, and there are a lot of conservative folks who use that phrase to mean one thing. There are those of us on the left who use it to mean something else. But usually what we're talking about, we're fighting over money and funding, which is important, don't get me wrong, or we're fighting over a certain degree of teacher training, which is important, don't get me wrong. But we're not talking about fundamentally uprooting the curriculum and the pedagogical approach. And in part, it's because we don't fully appreciate the depths of the problem. We think that the educational system in America is broken and just needs to be fixed with some tinkering. Let me suggest to you the radical idea, perhaps, for some, that the education system is not broken at all. It is working exactly as it is intended to work. It was set up to produce inequality. We know this. We know this because we give standardized tests to unstandardized students from unstandardized backgrounds, unstandardized families, teachers, curriculum, and neighborhoods, and then we call that fairness. So we know it is deliberate. Thomas Jefferson said it was deliberate. In Notes on the State of Virginia, Thomas Jefferson said we needed 6 years of compulsory schooling for everyone. He just meant white people, of course, but for all white folks, needed 6 years of compulsory schooling so that we could rake a few geniuses from the rubbish. Right? In other words, the point of schooling was to figure out the handful of really bright people and everybody else was going to work for them, right? William Bennett, former Secretary of Education under Reagan, until recently the worst Secretary of Education that we'd had, but... You know, records are meant to be broken, so they all fall eventually. You know, Lou Gehrig used to have the longest streak for consecutive baseball games. They said that one would never fall. It did, and so did Bill Bennett. So things happen. But Bill Bennett was on one of the talk shows in 2001 or 2002, right after No Child Left Behind passed, you know, the Bush-era education reform. And when they asked him what's the biggest problem in schools today or education today, his answer was very revealing. He said too many people are going to college. Right? Now, who did he mean? He didn't say, but you know, right? He doesn't mean the rich and mediocre children of rich and mediocre parents. He's not talking about the kind of folks that used to get gentlemen C's at Harvard and Yale just for showing up, right? He's talking about working class people. He's talking about people of color. It's sort of the mentality of the slave owner, right? If they all learn to read, who's going to pick this cotton, right? So the whole system's predicated on inequality. When a system's predicated on inequality, it's like if you think of it as an app on your phone, right? It's not a glitch. It's not a bug. It's a feature of the app. It's actually programmed in, right? So if we're going to change it, we have to talk about more than just reform. We have to view education as a revolutionary act, and that means we have to push for an entirely different approach. Let me tell you what that might look like in addition to what I said. We do have some examples of this. We know in Tucson, as just one example, and there are several others I could offer you, but Tucson Unified School District in Arizona 15 years ago, roughly, with some amazing educators from the University of Arizona, created the ethnic studies program, Mexican-American studies, or La Raza studies program at TUSD. And it was a voluntary program. You didn't have to go through it, but the idea was here was an opportunity to take your high school classes using a Chicanx lens, essentially, a Mexican-American lens, to look at everything, literature, art, philosophy, history, science, math, all of it through the lens of the Chicanx community. And you didn't have to be Chicanx to go through this program. Most of the kids probably were Mexican-American, but you didn't have to be. About 1,700 kids went through this program, right? And interestingly, it's a very good experiment to see the benefit of ethnic studies, right? Because in that situation, you've got kids who live in the same neighborhoods, come from the same kind of demographic background. Some are taking this curriculum and others are taking the normal standard curriculum, so you can compare the outcome, right? Because in every other way, they're pretty much the same demographically. So the 1,700 kids that went through the program, 7 out of 10 approximately went on to college after graduation. The kids who were just like them from the same neighborhood, same demographics, who didn't go through the Mexican American Studies lens program, only about 17% of them went on to college. So this was a program that was working to light a fire under kids who had been written off by the school district. And what did the state of Arizona do? They came in, they canceled the program, said it was teaching anti-American, anti-white bigotry, right? And now the courts, luckily, a couple years ago, overruled that and said it was unconstitutional to shut the program down. But by that time, a lot of the principal people in the program had moved on to other endeavors. And so, in effect, the program is gone now. But what that tells us is we do have evidence that we can bring to bear in our school districts that this works. It works to liberate the marginalized. And I'm talking about not just economically and culturally, but intellectually. It lights a fire under them because it connects the learning to their lived experience. We know it can work. We need examples like that. That's just one. There are several others, but I believe that if we start to fight for that, as opposed to just we need a little more money here, a little more money here, a little more training here, a little more choice here, a little more options here, maybe get rid of standardized testing, which I would love to do, but we've got to fundamentally alter what we think education is about. Is education about individual success or is it about collective success? Because under segregation, black folks knew it couldn't be about individual success. You were only going to be allowed to rise so high. So the black community had to do what? Develop a notion of education as collective liberation. It's all of us or none of us. Right? And we need to get back to that because what we ended up doing was integrating the buildings and the bodies, but not the philosophies. We didn't take that black philosophy of schooling and put it into new multiracial, multi-ethnic integrated schools. Had we done so, we might be in a very different place today. Yes, next question.
My name is Bill Brown. I love your Medium posts. I'm not an academic, so please forgive this question, but...
Neither am I, so no
worries. Okay, good. Yeah. Well, I'm used to my wife. She is. Yeah. What can we actually do? Practical applications, actual steps.
So here's the thing. I think the first thing we have to do is maybe break from the tendency that I think we all have, because I've asked this question that you've just asked many times. We have to break free from the tendency to ask that question. And here's why. Here's why. Well, not to ask it, but not to ask it of talking heads or experts or people behind podiums like me, right? Because the answers to what we have to do aren't going to come from talking heads and experts or academics or authors. It would be, I think, incredibly arrogant of me and really white for me to think that after 400 years of people of color trying to figure out the way to crack the code of white supremacy, that this 51-year-old white kid from, I say kid still, I don't know why I do that. You know, it's funny. My old bio, Felicia will remember, used to say, Tim Wise is one of America's leading young social critics. This has been a very long time ago, I should point out. The idea that a 51-year-old white guy from Nashville has figured out the answer to that question, very unlikely. The answers to that question, your question, which is a good one, that's going to come in community. We're going to find that collectively when we gather in those church basements like they did during the days of segregation to plot the strategy to break the back of apartheid in the South. In groups like SNCC. It's gonna come about when you get with groups like Surge that are tabling at this event, showing up for racial justice and work with other folks to figure out what are the strategies that, let's say in particular, white folks can adopt. And then working with groups like the Movement for Black Lives and others that are working on issues led and groups led by people of color. That's where we're gonna find those answers. We might have some good ideas individually, but collectively is where we're gonna actually come up with the strategies and with the steps. I think one thing that we can do, having said that there's not much other than joining in these formations, one thing we certainly can do is learn to tell a different story. And here's what I mean. I think part of the problem in this country, and I talk about this a little bit in the last book I did, Under the Affluence, part of the problem in this culture is that we're so embedded in the idea that I talked about earlier, this notion of rugged individualism, that even people who are sort of progressive fall into it in certain ways. We still like to take credit for our stuff. We still like to, you know, sort of take credit for our successes. And even if we're not quite successful yet in what we do, we want to believe, right, that if we just work a little harder, it'll all work out, because that makes us feel like we're the captains of our own ship, right? We don't want to admit that there's a lot that goes into where we are in life and what we've obtained. And even people that are relatively progressive sometimes fall into it. I think we need to tell a different story, and we need to be radically humble about how we got to where we are. Because if we tell our stories and we're honest and we're open about both the privileges that we've had, and I don't just mean white privileges, I mean male privileges, I mean straight privileges, I mean able-bodied privileges, I mean Christian privilege in a Christian hegemonic society, I mean all the different ways in which we have certain advantages, that will allow us to be considerably more open to those who haven't had those privileges and advantages and working to ensure that they obtain them. Similarly, if we're honest enough about the luck that has come into our lives, which we don't like to admit. Nobody likes to admit luck. Sometimes people think they're being very philosophical when they say things like, well, I don't believe in luck. There's no such thing as luck. You make your own luck. Oh, really? You think? Because there's three and a half billion people on the planet who are living on less than $2 a day. So what'd they do wrong exactly? Right? Like, what did they do wrong that you did right? Stop fooling yourself. Oh, you believe in destiny? Really? Let me repeat. There's 3.5 billion people on the planet living on less than $2 a day. If you believe that that's destiny, you are a particularly cruel individual. Right? That's nonsensical. But we tend to believe it. We don't want to admit luck, because if I admit I've had luck, then my luck could go sideways next week, and I don't want to acknowledge that. But we have to acknowledge it. And you may think, well, this is sort of a trite thing. How does this matter? Let me tell you why it matters. The minute that I get clear on my story and I share that story with others, then it frees them to tell their story truthfully. And you might think that doesn't matter, but let me just model so you understand how much it matters, right? So I'm going to tell you my story real quick, make it real brief. Why am I here? I'm here because, as you heard in the bio, first thing I did out of college was the work against David Duke in Louisiana. That was high-profile work. Here's this former Klan leader, most prominent modern Nazi in the United States at the time, almost becoming a U.S. senator, almost becoming governor. So those of us involved in that work got a lot of shine, got a lot of attention. That pretty much set my career in place. If I don't do that work, I'm probably not doing what I'm doing now. In fact, I'm certainly not. Well, how did I get that job? I got that job because the two guys that started the organization were friends of mine. One was a professor at Tulane, where I went to undergrad. The other was a grad student at Tulane who I met while I was there. If I don't meet them, I don't get that job. I don't get to fight David Duke. I'm not doing what I'm doing right now. Why did I meet them? Because I went to Tulane. If I go anywhere else, I'm not going to meet them. Why did I go to Tulane? I went to Tulane because I was chasing a girl that was going to Louisiana State. She was going to LSU. She convinced me that I had to go to Tulane. I wasn't thinking about Tulane. I was a high school debater. I know, shocking. And in high school, I had no intention of going to Tulane. I was going to go to Emory in Atlanta. I was being recruited by their debate coach. That's where I thought I was going to go. That was going to be my path. But I met this girl at a debate camp in the summer of 1985 between my junior and senior years in Washington, D.C., fell in love in the manner of a 16-year-old. And Monica said to me, you can't go to Emory. If you go to Emory, we will never see each other. You have to go to Tulane. Have you ever thought of Tulane? I'm like, no, but I'll go. So I changed my whole life trajectory for this young woman. And as a result of that, met those men who gave me that job so I could fight David Duke and get out here and do the work I do today. Why did I go to Tulane? I met Monica. Why did I meet Monica? Because I was a debater who met her that summer. Why was I a debater? Because even though you might think that was always my path, given my argumentativeness and my speaking and all of that, the truth is it wasn't. I was an athlete. I was a jock. I was a really good baseball player. I should point out, just as a side note, so I don't want to brag too much, I wasn't as good of a baseball player as Donald Trump, apparently. I don't know if you know this. I don't know if you know this story. Donald Trump is on record saying, just so you know, that he was the best baseball player in the city of New York in 1962. For those of you who follow baseball, you might remember that the New York Yankees won the World Series in 1962. But Donald Trump wants you to know that he was better than Mickey Mantle. He was better than Roger Maris and Whitey Ford and Yogi Berra and whoever else was still on the team at that point. I wasn't Donald Trump good, but I was good. I was good enough to have college scouts and recruiters at my little league games, and I thought that was going to be my path. But then I tried out for the high school team, and I had an inexplicably terrible tryout. Sometimes it happens. You're nervous. You didn't get enough rest. I'm trying out against a bunch of guys I've been playing against for 5 and 6 years. I was as good or better than all of them. But I got cut, and I had to find a new activity, right? And the activity was debate. If I make the team, which I should have, based on my prior skill set, I'm not going to be debating. I'm not going to be at summer camp meeting Monica. I'm going to be playing ball in the summer, and my path is going to be entirely different, right? Just telling that story allows other people to think about all the things that could have gone different in their lives. And if we would all be more honest about that, think how hard it would be to look down on people that hadn't made it. think how hard it would be to continue rationalizing inequality. Because if I'm honest about how I could have been you and you could have been me, if just a few things are different, all of a sudden it opens up entirely different possibilities. So the one thing I would encourage everyone to do is take stock, take inventory of how you got from point A to point B and all the people that helped you along the way and all the things that could have gone differently. Because if you know that, then you can commit to being that help for someone else and for the society as a whole. And if we don't do that, I don't think we'll ever be that help. And so that's something we can do right now. Sorry for the long-winded answer, but I just wanted to make sure I said that. Yeah.